From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
It's touch and go for the biggest trade deal in history. Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Barack Obama has been negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership with 11 Asian Pacific countries, although details are secret. He calls it a vital opening to Asian markets that are key to American prosperity. Most Republicans agree, but his own party is sharply divided. Elizabeth Warren and other progressives see a giveaway of national sovereignty with billions of taxpayer dollars going to multinational corporations. Labor leaders and environmentalists call it NAFTA on steroids. We'll hear both sides. Today's talking point, would higher education for prisoners make society safer? Who should pay? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Last night, President Obama insisted he's a champion of the middle class, calling Senator Elizabeth Warren, environmentalists, and organized labor flat-out wrong for opposing his massive trade deal with 11 Asian Pacific nations. We'll hear from defenders of the trade deal and from opponents, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Today's talking point, after objections about the use of taxpayer money, Governor Andrew Cuomo recently scrapped a college education program at New York State prisons. We'll talk to an inmate who's about to get a degree about rehabilitation and safety behind bars. First, this news update. Saudi Arabian planes bombed Yemen again today, despite yesterday's announcement that the month-long air war was over. The Yemeni civil war is considered part of a proxy battle between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and U.S. support for the Saudis could have an impact on negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. That's according to Yochi Drazen, who is managing editor of News at Foreign Policy Magazine. Good as always to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. It's a pleasure.
Is the administration missing the connection?
It's not that they're missing it. It's that they're trying to obscure it. If you talk to quite literally a diplomat from any country in the region, from Israel to Saudi Arabia to the United Arab Emirates, they say that Yemen and the nuclear talks are linked. And much more specifically and much more pointedly, they believe that the White House is willing to turn a blind eye to Iranian meddling in Yemen because it doesn't want to derail the nuclear talks.
Here's
all of our allies see a link, even if we say there's not.
Here is a statement yesterday from Josh Earnest, who, of course, is the White House press spokesperson. He was asked if Iran's behavior will be a sticking point in the nuclear negotiations.
The fact that Iran engages in a wide variety of other behaviors that are concerning to us is not a reason to break up those negotiations. In fact, it is a very strong incentive for those negotiations to succeed.
Back to Yochi Drazen. How do you see that statement?
I think that's in the sort of category of absolute best-case scenario. If you talk to the White House, they'll say, you have an Iran deal, you have ties to Iran that have begun to normalize, then you could maybe talk to them about what they're doing in Iraq, what they're doing in Lebanon, what they're doing in Yemen. If you talk to people, again, in Israel and the Gulf, they'll say, that's naive, that what you're basically doing is ceding power to them, and the more you cede it, getting it back in any country becomes virtually impossible. So that kind of statement, it just rings false and it rings empty to the ears of diplomats in the region.
Is the U.S. willing, then, as you are you suggesting, to pay too high a price to get the negotiations done?
I think it comes down to a question of how the White House ultimately sees its legacy and sees its top goal. Right now, they seem willing to risk a permanent rupture in ties with Israel, with Saudi Arabia, with Kuwait, with United Arab Emirates, because they think this deal is a historic game changer for the entire region. Right now, it seems they're willing to pay virtually any price for that deal. If it pays off and it is a landmark, historic game changer, that price may be worth it. If it doesn't, the damage it's already done may be potentially irreversible.
But what are the alternatives to having a nuclear deal with Iran?
So I think virtually everyone, right side or left side, at this point agrees that there has to be a deal. The alternative that you hear from Democratic hawks and from virtually all Republicans is not this deal. That if sanctions have made Iran willing to negotiate, put on more sanctions so they're willing to concede more. The concern is less about, I mean, separate aside the kind of political blather. when you get down to it, the concern is not about should there be a deal, should there not be a deal. The concern is this the best deal we could get, or is the White House so eager for a deal that's conceding too much?
Do we know enough about what has been discussed and how the deal is shaping up for you to say we should do something differently?
No, and I think that that's another source of concern. You have the White House saying there is a framework agreement, the details are being worked out between now and June, but that its details and the main points have already been agreed to. You have Iranian leaders, beginning with Ayatollah Khamenei and then coming down, saying, no, the things that you, the U.S., are saying we've agreed to, we have not agreed to. So it's not that I, as a journalist or other journalists, can say there are these terms, there's this agreement, it's good, it's bad. It's that the U.S. says there's a deal and describes it one way. The Iranians say there is not a deal and describe it very differently. And for the moment, that has not been squared.
Back to where we began, should the United States then be pressuring Saudi Arabia not to be so hard on Yemen?
I think in some ways it's pushing on an open door, because the air campaign wasn't working. What was very interesting yesterday, the statement the Saudis put out about announcing that it was ending, it said it accomplished its goals, but the goals that it described accomplishing were very limited. It wasn't restoring the former government. It wasn't defeating the Houthis. It was, we destroyed some weaponry on our border. I think there's a realization in Saudi Arabia, even before this, and even without any pressure from the U.S., that the airstrikes weren't doing a whole lot, and that you were risking other damage, human casualties on the ground, potential tensions with the U.S., for something that you weren't gaining much from in the first place.
Where do you think the U.S. might draw the line? It has long denied that it would be willing to tolerate Iranian misbehavior, if that's what we're talking about, in exchange for the nuclear talks.
I think if there was clear evidence of direct Iranian support, not simply funneling weapons or money to the Houthis, but actual Iranian troops or Iranian intelligence operatives fighting against the Saudis, if you had evidence of that was going on, that it had reached that level, probably that becomes a red line of sorts. If it stays beneath that, and it's sort of a proxy war of Houthis fighting the Saudis where the Iranians can deny it, most people in the world have no idea what a Houthi is and really couldn't care less what a Houthi is, I don't think that gets to the point where the White House would say enough is enough.
Okay. In the meantime, the Iranian talks are ongoing with a deadline of June 30th. Yochi Drizin, again, managing editor of News at Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks, as always, for being on our program.
My pleasure, Warren.
In a moment, it's touch and go for the biggest trade deal in history on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a massive trade deal involving the U.S. and 11 other Asian-Pacific countries. Having negotiated since 2009, President Obama wants it as part of his legacy. He's asking Congress to reauthorize so-called fast-track authority. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is the most prominent of many progressives staunchly opposed, and last night on MSNBC, the president addressed her directly.
I love Elizabeth. We're allies on a whole host of issues, but she's wrong on this. And when you hear folks make a lot of suggestions about how bad this trade deal is, when you dig into the facts, they are wrong.
Senator Bernie Sanders is an independent from Vermont. He's said to be considering a run for the presidency. He's opposed to granting fast-track authority and to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Senator, welcome to the Point.
Good to be with you.
You apparently had something to do with delaying the consideration of fast-track authority in the Senate today. I won't go into the details of Senate rules with you, but it's an index, I think, for our listeners of how deeply opposed you are. First of all, what is fast-track authority? What does that mean?
Well, what Fast Track does is say that if it is passed, when the final bill comes to the floor, there will be no opportunity for amendments. It'll be 51 votes, and it'll be a take it or leave it. So it basically restricts the ability of the Congress to amend and improve the legislation.
What amendments do you think will be needed?
Well, it's not a question, Warren, of amendments. To my mind, the TPP is building on a track record of disastrous trade agreements in the past. I voted against NAFTA, I voted against CAFTA, I voted against permanent normal trade relations with China because I perceived that these are trade agreements which would allow companies in this country to shut down, move to low-wage countries abroad, and bring their products back into this country. And that's exactly what happened. NAFTA has resulted in the loss of some million American jobs. The Chinese trade agreement has resulted in the loss of more than 3 million American jobs. I think everybody understands it is harder and harder to buy products manufactured in the United States of America, and that over a period of years, we've lost millions of decent-paying manufacturing jobs. So, Warren, my point of view is if we have had trade agreements that have failed and failed and failed again, why do you want to continue on that same path? What we need to do is change our trade policies, come up with policies that work for the American worker and not just for large multinational corporations.
The president insists that the situation is not what you describe, that this is different from past agreements, particularly because it has environmental protections in it, and according to him, it protects organized labor.
Well, actually, if you check it out, and I was on the floor of the House, floor of the Senate this morning talking about it, that's what they always say. It's exactly what they always say. The truth is that in Vietnam right now, is a party to this Trans-Pacific Partnership, the minimum wage is 56 cents an hour. In Malaysia, there is a study out there that says some of the people in the Malaysian electronics industry are literally slave labor. American workers would be forced to compete against people who make pennies an hour. Corporations will do what they always do, shut down in this country, go to areas where there is low-wage labor. Furthermore, there are other parts of this agreement that we have really strong concerns about, and that is the ability of private corporations to sue or take to a independent international tribunal governments, local, state, federal, or countries around the world that are doing things like trying to protect the environment or trying to protect the health of their people. And corporations can say, well, this action of trying to prevent kids from smoking cigarettes is a terrible thing. It's ruining our ability to make a profit. And therefore, we're going to go to a private tribunal and get damage for this company, for this country, for helping their kids stay off of tobacco.
I take it your concern is the makeup of the independent tribunal, which you think would be more in favor of the corporation involved and its concern about losing profits if, in fact, the kind of law you describe is overruled.
That's part of it, but it's the idea. This is a major effort to undermine democracy, not only in America, but around the world. You know what? Governments representing their people have a right to do their best in trying to protect the environment and health of their people. And the idea that a private corporation could sue a country because they are trying to keep their kids from smoking and impacting the profits of a tobacco industry is virtually insane. I mean, it is beyond comprehension. Or if a country moves forward to protect the environment, say it's anti-fracking or whatever it may be, and a corporation said, look, I wanted to go in there. I had an opportunity to make a whole lot of money, and this legislation prevented me from making money. This country is going to have to pay a fine for doing that. So not only is it a negative in terms of protecting people and the environment and healthcare and the health of our people, it is also undermining American democracy. The goal of democracy is not to maximize corporate profits. It's to do the best that we can for the people of our countries.
Is this also a loss of national sovereignty?
Sure it is. If the state of Vermont passes legislation that our people think makes sense and some corporation sues us because we are inhibiting their profits, what does that say about government? What does that say about democracy? It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is corporate profits. So I think the bottom line here is that what we have seen year after year is the middle class in this country disappear. Today, we have more people living in poverty than almost any time in the modern history of this country, and the wealthiest people and the largest corporations are doing phenomenally well. One of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons for that development is our disastrous trade policies. We have lost 60,000 factories in America since 2001, and a lot of them have to do with trade. That means people who used to be able to make middle-class wages now are working in McDonald's making minimum wage. So our job right now is to say to corporate America, you want us to buy your products. How about building those products here in the United States? How about putting our people to work and stop running to China and other low-wage countries?
You have said that Hillary Clinton ought to make herself clear on this issue. Will her answer to that question, her response to your challenge, determine whether or not you decide to run for president?
No. I think this is one of many, many issues. And it's not just Hillary Clinton. It is every candidate running for president of the United States. I understand that trade is not a sexy issue, you know, but it is a very, very important issue. And I think Secretary Clinton and every other candidate has got to make it clear what your view is on this issue. Either you're for it or you're against it, and that's about it. And as I've said, I think this is a continuation of failed trade policies. I think we need a new approach to trade which protects American workers. I would hope very much that Secretary Clinton would join me in that view.
What about a candidacy for a president? How much support do you think that you have at this point?
Well, I can tell you that I think we have a whole lot of support all over this country. I think that the American people are sick and tired of a process in which today, if you can believe this, 99% of all new income is going to the top 1%, where you have the top 0.1% in this country owning as much wealth as the bottom 90%, and you got millions of workers working longer hours for low wages while the people on top are doing phenomenally well. And people are also concerned about this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which is allowing billionaires now to buy elections and control our political process, not to mention climate change and the need to aggressively move away from fossil fuel. So there are huge issues facing the American people. And I think that all over this country, there is a lot of support for a strongly progressive agenda which says enough is enough. The United States government has got to start working for the middle class and working families of America, not just the billionaire class. Now, having said that, getting involved in a national presidential election is not a small thing. And at a time when the billionaires will be spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars trying to elect their candidates, I've got to make a determination as to whether or not we can raise the kind of money we need to run a winning campaign. I don't need billions of dollars, but I at least would need a reasonable sum of money to allow us to compete effectively. And that's kind of what we're looking at right now.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise, if I do run, the vast majority of the money that I will raise will come from small individual contributions. That's the way I did it as the U.S. Senator from the state of Vermont. That's the way I'll continue to do it. But, you know, when the Koch brothers themselves talk about spending $900 million in this election cycle, you know, if I got 3 million people, I mean, an extraordinary number, to contribute $100 apiece, that would be one-third of what one family itself is going to put into the political process. So that's kind of the issue that we have to deal with.
All right, Bernie Sanders, a U.S. Senator, independent U.S. Senator, I should say, from Vermont. Thanks so much for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gary Hufbauer is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. We're back now on the issue of the trade pact, the Pacific Asian trade pact. And Dr. Hufbauer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How do you respond to the arguments as a supporter of this trade deal that we heard from Bernie Sanders? Which are the most important ones, do you think?
Senator Sanders is extremely eloquent and puts on a strong case. I disagree with every major point that he has put forward. But let me start with the top, which he didn't mention, and that is American leadership of the world economy. That's been the situation during my lifetime since the Second World War. And we have led every major international trade agreement. Of course, we're leaders in the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and many other institutions. If Senator Sanders and his allies in this battle prevail, this will mean the end of an era. I mean, it is a very decisive battle. This is as important as what happened at the very end of the Second World War, which I suspect most of your listeners were not very conscious of those years. I was, but that was a decisive period. this would represent this defeat of the fast track, and then the Trans-Pacific Partnership would represent the U.S. turning away from the international economy. This is a gateway agreement. It would open up future possibilities for the U.S. to engage with other Asian countries, which I doubt Senator Sanders welcomes. It would also open up U.S. engagement with Europe in the so-called Trans-Atlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, and open up U.S. engagement again with the World Trade Organization. That's 161 countries. If this goes down, none of that will happen. There will be other leaders in the world, and you could probably identify two of them. One would be Europe, the other would be China. But our values will not go forward. Now, let me turn to
reiterate something that some of the things that Senator Sanders said. He said that what you refer to as leadership of the world economy, NAFTA, CAFTA, the deal right. with China, have in fact put the United States in a position where U.S. workers will have to compete with people in Vietnam making 56 cents an hour and with slave labor in Malaysia, and that there's a tribunal system set up that will be making decisions not in favor of American policies and laws, but rather the policies and profits of international companies.
Yeah, let me disagree with those points one by one. The senator puts out an image, which used to be called the pauper labor argument, that the cheaper a country's labor is, the more successful they are as a trading partner. Factually, that is just not true. If that were true, most of our trade would be with Africa. In this continent, it would be with Haiti. It just doesn't happen. Most of our trade is with other advanced countries because countries have a lot of abilities besides low wages. In fact, low wages generally means very a lot of difficulties in terms of electricity, worker habits, and so forth and so on. And the whole economic system may be chaotic.
We're getting close to when we have to go to a break. What about the International Tribune, the independent tribunal that he says would be a counteract American democracy?
Well, before we get to that, I want to just put out a statistic which we've worked on very hard here at the Institute. You can refer to it. We think the average American family is at least $5,000 a year richer thanks to our trade agreements. This is a big number. Now, the tribunal issue. We have a lot of arbitration panels in the United States. That's a very common way of settling disputes. If a company invests in another country, it can't necessarily be assured of the honesty, the promptness of the courts in that country. And that's the whole reason for this tribunal system, of which there are more than 1,000 examples. Senator Sanders, like Senator Warren, throws out hypothetical cases. They can't point to any actual decisions which illustrate their points.
Okay.
They don't exist.
I'm going to interrupt you, and I apologize for that. As I indicated, we need to go to a break. We're talking with Dr. Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. We'll come back, continue this conversation with him and with others as well. On our talking point today, would higher education behind bars make society safer? If so, who should pay for it? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
Norman Olnebeck with To The Point. We are deep in the weeds today talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the biggest trade deal in history. President Obama has been negotiating it. He wants fast-track authority for Congress to approve it without amendment, either an up or down vote. We heard Senator Bernie Sanders, who's much opposed to it, has delayed consideration of it today in the Senate, and a response from Dr. Gary Hufbauer of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. What we've heard from him is that past trade deals, NAFTA, CAFTA, and deal with China, similar to this but not as big, have in fact left the American family $5,000 richer than it would have been otherwise. And he says that if it were true that trading with low-wage countries was good for them, then we would be dealing with Haiti and Africa instead of the trading partners we already have. Harold Meyerson is a columnist for The Washington Post. He's editor-at-large of The American Prospect, has a different view. Harold Meyerson, good to have you on our program.
And always good to be here, Warren.
How do you respond to what we heard from Dr. Hufbauer?
Well, I think his numbers don't really coincide or gel very well with some commonly accepted numbers, that manufacturing workers have had to take 20% pay cuts on average when they get their job after their factory closes, with the fact that, as everyone, I presume, and at the Peterson Institute, that's a bunch of smart people, acknowledges that the median family income is still below that of 2001, and that the average male wage is no higher than 1973. So that if trade does increase a family's income by an average of $5,000, then everything else in the American economy must have gone incredibly haywire for this aggregate decline still to encompass that shift. And actually, I don't believe that. If you look in particular at what wasn't exactly a trade deal, but the extension of permanent normalized trade relations to China, which I think is the key piece of trade-related legislation that Congress has enacted over the past quarter century, it's very clear that American corporations just flock to China, in part for the low wages and in part for the potential to be close to all those consumers, and that American manufacturing has clearly transferred out. Now, look, it's very hard to separate the aggregate phenomenon of globalization from particular trade deals. And I think one reason the opposition to things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership is so intense is that the American people never really have been afforded an up or down vote on globalization per se. Shall we enter into trade relations with countries that pay a great deal less than we do? And that the trade deals that come up really are the only forum in which these kinds of things, however imperfectly, can be discussed. And so people fearing the continuing lowering of American incomes, which I assume the Peterson Institute does acknowledge is a reality, say for the top 1%, this is the outlet for that utterly justifiable frustration. Then one thing about the tribunals on the decide on these trade cases, they don't have any support in Europe. If we are going to enter after this into a trade agreement with the nations of Europe, which is a proposal that's out there and is in some ways more conceptually interesting than the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because in some ways it's a trade deal with nations that have higher labor standards and higher wages than we do in many cases. It's going to have to deal with the fact that Germany and other countries see these as fundamentally undemocratic, and that it's a perception not of the left, but of the right as well in Europe, that Angela Merkel, in her previous government, when she was aligned with a more right-wing party, the Free Democrats, expressed considerable opposition to these tribunals. They simply do not work very well with any kind of democratic theory, particularly since we don't know who the judges are, the proceedings aren't held in public, These are really unaccountable kangaroo courts.
All right. Dr. Hufbauer, back to you with the Peterson Institute. Obviously, we could go back and forth on these issues for the rest of the day. Given what Harold said about the opportunity of Americans to have a voice in all of this, why should this be conducted in secret under the fast track? Why shouldn't it be open, available to the public? Why shouldn't we know the details of it? And why shouldn't Congress be able to vote on amendments?
Well, that's another canard. The Congress has been very heavily briefed on the TPP as going forward. More than 1,000 meetings between the USTR and various congressmen have been held. When it comes time to sign the bill, there will be a lot more briefings, a lot more notice. According to the fast-track bill, which has been introduced, the president, the total text will need to be released 60 days before the president actually signs it, and then Congress will have another 60 or 90 days to deliberate.
So Howard Morrison, why isn't that good enough?
Well, for one thing, this is a last-minute concession to win Democratic votes. I mean, the Democratic base, labor and environmentalists and most progressives, and that's the Democratic base, has been complaining about the inaccessibility of the text and things like that. And so this is a last-minute change. It's only come up in the last week. That one would have welcomed some time ago, but also it doesn't really kick in until the next trade agreement. I mean, some of its provisions. So this is a little bit about the toothpaste already being out of the tube. But is it a step in the right direction? Yes, it is. They just need 25 more such steps.
Let me go back to, no, excuse me, let me introduce Caitlin Weber, who is a Washington analyst focusing on trade policy for Bloomberg. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Tell us about the history of what we're talking about here, because these arguments obviously have been going on for a long time, but they get bigger and bigger and more important to the economy as time goes on.
Right. Trade Promotion Authority in particular, that's definitely not a new bill. That's been around, you know, for 40-plus years, and almost every president has had it, with the exception of President Obama. It actually expired in 2007. And essentially what Trade Promotion Authority does is it's sort of like a deal between Congress and the president, because the Constitution gives Congress the authority to raise and lower tariffs, but it gives the president the authority to negotiate treaties. And so under Trade Promotion Authority legislation, Congress lays out negotiating objectives for the president and his trade negotiators to follow. And in exchange, Congress says that they will consider a trade deal once finalized if it abides by those negotiating objectives on an expedited timeline and without amendments. And the reason for the expedited timeline and the up or down vote, it's essentially because trade negotiators say they would never be able to get the best deal out of our trade partners if the negotiations were open, and if they knew that that Congress at the last minute could change the trade deal, and then negotiators would have to go back to the table. So that's really the background on Trade Promotion Authority. The last time that Congress had this big debate over trade was 2002, and a lot of things have changed. The economy has really changed, and I think, you know, for the next couple of months at least, we'll be seeing, a lot of debate about the issue.
What do you think are the prospects at this point? We heard today that Senator Sanders was able to hold up consideration of fast-track authority in one of the committees of the Senate. We don't know as yet what Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House think about this, do we?
We do know. Most Democrats in the House, including Nancy Pelosi, most of them are quite skeptical of free trade deals. There are a group of more centrist, moderate Democrats, more pro-business Democrats who have a history of voting for these deals. But in the Senate, it's really, I think, it's more bipartisan than in the Congress. The fast-track trade Trade Promotion Authority bill that's being considered today. And the chairman of the committee, Chairman Hatch, said that they will come back and they'll be there late tonight to debate the bill if they have to. The highest Democrat on that committee, Ron Wyden of Oregon, he's a co-sponsor of the Trade Promotion Authority legislation. I think the whipping for this vote is going to be very difficult. And, of course, both sides right now are saying that they think that they have the votes to defeat it or to get Trade Promotion Authority. But I do think it's really close, and it's a pretty difficult vote for a lot of Democrats.
Whipping, of course, is the rounding up of votes one way or the other, a wonderful metaphor for what happens politically. Again, Caitlin Weber is with Bloomberg, where she focuses on trade policy as an analyst. Harold Meyerson, back to you. What are the prospects, do you think, in the House? Is this pretty certain to go through with Republican votes, or are there Republicans as well who are skeptical about it?
Well, there are Republicans as well who don't want to hand President Obama a victory, no matter what the issue, and who some of whom respond to the diminution of national sovereignty argument, most likely located in the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party. Now, one thing we know from John Boehner's record as Speaker and head of the Republicans in the House is that when they don't want to vote with him, and he's obviously for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they just go ahead and don't vote with him. He doesn't have much ability to move them at all. Indeed, most House Republicans are fearful of primary challenges from their right. Almost none, I think, are fearful of primary challenges from their left. So there was some number of Republicans, and I don't know how many, who are not going to vote for this. And so in the Democratic camp, it has always been harder to get House Democrats to support trade agreements than Senate Democrats. House Democrats are really kind of more responsive to their district economies. And when, as Senator Sanders notes, 60,000 factories have closed in the current century, that's the kind of thing that registers and district to House members, somewhat less so in the Senate. When you enter the Senate, when you're in the Senate, you are somewhat more responsive to really big business and finance. And so the Senate has been a place that has been more inclined towards trade agreements and not so much in the House. But
okay.
I mean,
Caitlin Weber, do you buy that analysis? You agree with that?
Well, I do think that the vote will be a lot closer in the House than in the Senate. I think that there's about, I agree that there's probably about 20 House Republicans. These are folks who I think would feel okay being identified with the Tea Party.
Excuse me for interrupting, but you said closer in the House. Do you mean you think the Senate's going to pass it?
I think it's tough to say, but I think there's a better chance in the Senate than there is in the House. I think it's leaning towards the likelihood that they would pass it in the Senate.
Let me go back to Dr. Gary Hufbauer. Are you concerned that this won't pass, and particularly that Fast Track Authority won't pass? Let's take that first. If it fails, what then is likely to happen to the partnership?
Well, as I said at the beginning, if it fails, it's not just the partnership, it's the whole U.S. standing in the world economy. For the partnership, that's, in my view, the end of the partnership. The U.S. is the linchpin of it. Some countries won't have any interest in it. There may be a few countries. The partnership actually started with New Zealand and Chile and Brunei, Singapore. So they may go together and have an agreement, but it won't be what we're talking about now. It'll be a very different, much smaller picture, and leadership of the world economy will shift elsewhere. If I could just put in one more word, there's been all this talk by Senator Sanders and Mr. Meyerson about how this is just a benefit to corporations. There's no country which seems to not like its big business more than the United States. Every other country that I travel to, they love business because that's the innovation and so forth. And this notion that it only benefits business, I mean, that's like its only benefit, Mars. What does business do? It employs people. A lot of people work in export jobs and so forth. So this is a very one-sided kind of, I don't know, it's just out of this world view of the way the economy works.
Harold Meyerson, how do you respond to that?
people do work in export jobs, but the average wage for, let's say, auto workers on the assembly line has gone down to $15.30 due to, among other things, global competition and resistance to unionization by employers. So I don't think Mr. Hofbauer, who's an accomplished economist, really can argue that the distribution of income in the United States is anything but lopsided, and that this has happened as globalization has grown. And as Senator Sanders says, it's far from the only culprit, but boy, it is a culprit.
Caitlin Weber, back to you. Which industries will be most affected by the partnership one way or the other, if it passes or fails, and who are the winners and possible losers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as has been mentioned before, that this deal is absolutely enormous. It would be the largest free trade agreement ever. And so it really touches almost every sector of the economy. Looking first maybe at U.S. industries who are particularly in favor of the TPP, the retailers, textile manufacturers, these are, you know, a lot of companies who source apparel from Vietnam and from Asia, and currently the U.S. imposes pretty high tariffs on those garment imports, and so there are a lot of executives who work for companies like Nike and Hanes Brands who have said they're quite excited about the TPP.
What about the auto industry?
The U.S. auto industry, you know, was kind of on the fence until Japan joined the deal, and now they are very skeptical of the TPP, and indeed say that they, you know, will oppose it unless there's really strict provisions on currency manipulation in the deal.
All right. Obviously, enormously important, very complicated, but thank you all very much for helping us better understand it. Caitlin Weber, again, with Bloomberg, Washington analyst, focusing on trade policy. Harold Meyerson, Washington Post and editor, columnist for the Washington Post, editor-at-large of the American Prospect. Dr. Harry Hofbauer of the Peterson Institute, where he's a senior fellow, and our earlier guest, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont. Great to have you all on our program, and many thanks for being with us. The 1980s were the era of rehabilitation in American prisons. There were 350 college degree programs for inmates nationwide. In the 1990s, the country got tough on crime. It was an era of retribution, and opportunities for education were withdrawn. Now, at some prisons, some inmates are being allowed to take classes again. We'll hear from one of them and from one of his teachers in a moment on To the Point.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Warman Olney back with today's Talking Point. John J. Lennon is one of 2,300 inmates at New York's Attica Correctional Facility. He's doing 28 years to life for a murder committed in 2001. He's also the author of a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times. As one of 23 prisoners allowed to attend college classes, he'll get his associate's degree next month. We interviewed him recently about his vision for expanding education in prison by using TV.
Currently, the TV is not an education tool. It's an incapacitation tool. It's a tool to keep us kind of entertained in ourselves. So, you know, that's what the TV is for. It's kind of, but I propose that it could be used as an education tool if MOOCs, massive open online courses, were kind of like streamed onto the internal station, Channel 3, which are playing movies every day. I mean, there's nothing really educational on there. But what MOOCs will do is, we'll, you know, look what's on Channel 3. There's this interesting kind of lecture on from a Duke professor that's talking about existentialism or philosophy. And, you know, believe it or not, some people will tune in. And after the lecture is over, what they're going to do is they're going to go on their gates, hand on their bars, and they're going to talk about it. And I envision that's what will happen. I'm not saying it's a silver bullet. But I'm thinking that, you know, there are a lot of people than just me that want education in prison.
Will prison administrators and correctional officers that Lennon calls COs get on board?
I think generally the administration, like kind of like, I guess, the penologists, people that study the administrators, really, they're for education in prison. It makes it a safer place. If I'm working on a paper, you know, I'm over here banging away on my typewriter, I have other things on my mind. I'm not kind of shucking and jiving in the prison yard. I think, you know, overall, they understand that it makes prison a safer place. If you have a group full of guys that kind of really have their eye on the prize and are really trying to change themselves. You know, as far as the COs, I mean, some of the COs, you know, they're working class guys and gals. I mean, they got to put their kids through college, and I think, you know, obviously they can, you know, they wonder who's funding it. Currently, it's privately funded. It's not publicly funded. But I think that's where the conversation gets thick. It's who's going to fund this, and when you think of the public sector funding it, especially when college tuition nowadays has exploded, I think it's a tough sell sometimes. But that's why I actually think that the answers in the near future could be in the private sector.
Lennon told us how education has changed him during the first 14 years of his sentence of 28 years to life in prison.
I came into prison, you know, looking up to gangsters. You know, I look up to scholars and intellectuals now, like Dawn Larson, like Tim Golden, like these people, Bill Keller, and all these Nicholas Kristof, all these kind of people, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. I mean, I look up to these people now. How's it going to change my life? I mean, education has changed the view through which I view the world. I mean, I don't look up to gangsters anymore. I think it's a disgusting lifestyle. I didn't think like that when I came to prison 14 years ago. I thought, I thought in a disgusting way. I don't think like that today. And that's because of education. It's also because I'm sober and, you know, I'm a little in touch with my emotions a bit too, but I think education has a lot to do with that. So, I mean, education is everything. It really, like I said, changed the lens through which I view the world.
One of the people Lennon says he looked up to, we just heard this, is Doran Larson. He is a professor of English at Hamilton College, editor of the book Fourth City, Essays from the Prison in America. He teaches the creative writing workshop at Attica Prison, and he has worked with John Lennon. Doran Larson, thanks a lot for joining our program.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Is John Lennon an extraordinary person? He's obviously very articulate, very different from the person he describes himself as being when he first arrived in prison. Or is he right that everybody else could perhaps also show interest to be improved by access to higher education?
I think everybody else is a little bit too broad. For one thing, as most people know, or people who study realize, is the prisons have become the default mental health institutions in the United States. Since we closed those institutions, those people generally are often wind up in the prison. You also have a lot of folks who are extremely high rate of illiteracy in prisons, and that's work that can be done inside. And most states actually have pretty decent GED programs to get people up to speed on that end. One of the things I think that John is speaking to is the fact that there is quite a big sector of the prison population that actually could join almost immediately into prison education programs, higher education programs. And I've been working in this field for a number of years, organized the college program at Attica and another one here in central New York. And one of the things that people remark upon who work in these programs over and over again is it seems almost impossible to create a program large enough to satisfy the desire, which pushes right against the public perception that people inside aren't interested in education, they aren't interested in changing their lives. That's a perception from the outside, which has been translated into practice over the last 30 or 40 years. And it's also, you know, I think worth note that from 1945 to 1973, there was a broad political consensus that prisons really should be about rehabilitation, and programs were there. They may have had their problems, but the general consensus was that that's what prisons should do. And we moved in the early 70s and the 80s into a punishment mentality, and essentially we see the only sort of proper function of the prison is to be what's been called total incapacitation. No concern with what happens to people while they're inside, as long as they're simply kept from the outside. And I, you know, my conviction from reading literally hundreds and hundreds of essays from incarcerated people for the book project and electronic digital archive that I've been building, the American Prison Writing Archive, is that we can really see that population less as a complete negative with a simple drag on society as an enormous untapped resource of entrepreneurial skill, of intellectual skill. And right now, there's almost nothing being done to turn those, what potential there is inside, into skills that can be used on the outside, take people off the public dole. In New York State, it costs $60,000 a year to keep someone in prison and to turn them into taxpayers. And the majority of people, again, contrary to public opinion, the people inside do want to become exactly that. They want to become productive members of society outside.
Let me just interrupt you for a minute before we run out of time, because the points you're making are great. But you talk about outside perception. And one of the things that John Lennon said in his op-ed piece in the New York Times is that New York had a program which was funded by the state, but that the governor canceled it after there was protest over public sector money going to it. Do you think that he has a good idea when he says there ought to be private enterprise involved in this?
Right now, that looks like the only viable option. What happened was Governor Cuomo proposed putting money into that program. That never happened in those programs because the political pushback was so harsh. And right now, again, we're still in a kind of vengeance mentality. And as John points out, this wouldn't be such an issue if the high cost of higher education were not such an issue for the average taxpayer. To my mind, that's a false either-or question. People on the outside are not costing the state $60,000 a year to take care of. It costs about $10,000 to give someone a AA degree, give them the means to get an AA or an AS degree, a two-year degree, and that reduces their recidivism chances by 75%. If that person stays out for a single year longer than they might have otherwise, that pays for six other people to get an AAS degree. You know, imagine if you put that savings back into state tuition, right? So the savings are really, really obvious.
All right. Also worth pointing out, of course, that not everybody is serving 28 years to life, and people are going to get out. Perhaps it's better for society if they get out at least partially educated rather than not. That's all the time we have. I'm sorry for that. Doran Larson, again, at Hamilton College, editor of Fourth City, Essays from the Prison in America. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.